Today on Against the Grain, broken windows policing targets people perceived as disorderly, such as homeless people with mental illness. But what if broken windows tactics, rather than reducing disorder, actually foster it? I'm CS. Tony Sparks joins me to discuss a revealing case study of policing and punishment in San Francisco, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. 25 years ago, New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani famously adopted a so-called broken windows policing approach, one that was later adopted by other cities, including San Francisco. Broken windows policing emphasizes the importance of addressing minor disturbances and low-level offenses, such as those committed by homeless people deemed unsightly or threatening. The questions that my guest Tony Sparks sought to answer are, do broken windows tactics work when applied to homeless people with mental health issues? Do such tactics reduce the amount of perceived disorder on the streets, or do they accomplish something else? And what if, Sparks asked, what if broken windows policing actually fosters, actually reproduces, the very disorder that it targets? Tony Sparks is Associate Professor of Urban Studies and Planning at San Francisco State University. He's also a member of the Human Rights Workgroup of the Coalition on Homelessness San Francisco. Tony contributed an article about the impact of broken windows policing on homeless people with mental illness in San Francisco to the journal Social Justice. When Tony Sparks joined me recently in studio, he began with these remarks about historical efforts to police and punish homeless people in San Francisco and nationally.
San Francisco has used the police to roust and remove homelessness since literally the start of San Francisco. You know, early ugly laws, Antioquia laws, vagrancy laws, these were struck down in the 1970s, but up until then, it was de rigueur to remove unsightly and poor individuals from public streets. But even after the Papakristou decision that made vagrancy illegal, cities pretty much immediately began looking to new ways to move visibly poor people out of the public eye. And this really found its expression in the broken windows theory and the growth of quality of life policing that began in the 1990s, you know, in theory based on Wilson and Kelling's broken window theory. But I think its most famous practical application was Rudy Giuliani's zero tolerance policy in New York. That very much inspired then Mayor Frank Jordan here in San Francisco, that who ran on a platform of getting serious about what he referred to as street disorder and incivility, and that resulted in a dramatic use of the criminal code, particularly in terms of low-level offenses, things that we refer to now as quality of life offenses, that hadn't been necessarily used at that level at the time, the ramping up of uses, the use of things like littering and loitering laws as ways to move visibly poor people out of the public eye, specifically using the police.
Remind us what the hallmarks are of broken windows policing, that approach.
Well, let me do this in two ways. So in theory, the broken windows theory essentially says that when an area is left unchecked or ignored and it becomes run down or there's an appearance of disorder, that will beget more disorder, that small crimes will beget bigger crimes.
So the small crimes have to be addressed quickly.
So, right. So the idea is if you address small crimes quickly, you can reduce bigger crimes. Now, there's a great deal of argument over whether or not that is actually the case. In practice, the way that has expressed itself is in the policing of the movements of poor people in urban spaces. So the disorder has specifically framed as humans, as undesirable humans. You know, police are not actually out there fixing broken windows. It might be nice if they were, but what they are doing is removing people that appear undesirable.
And thus you refer in this article to the spatial management of populations. And by spatial management, I take it you mean this kind of this movement and displacement and dislocation of people.
Absolutely. You know, one of the key hallmarks of broken windows policing as a social order, social maintenance strategy is not about solving the problems of homelessness or street level crime, but literally removing them from public view. And that means largely moving them from more desirable to less desirable or to spaces where they can't be seen. So it's about physical movement of problems, not necessarily, you couldn't see this, but problems in quotes, rather than addressing them through something like shelter or benefits.
What has neoliberalism done in the sense of the way in which cities are conceived of, in which urban spaces are thought of as maybe catering to, for example, elites or consumers? What has that approach done to efforts by cities to try to remove poor people and people deemed disorderly from urban spaces, public spaces?
Wow, that is a really big question. okay, let me see if I can do this in a thumbnail. So beginning, you know, in the early 1980s, shifts in the federal government away from a Keynesian model of domestic production and consumption and federal government spending on infrastructure and social reproduction and social programs towards reducing federal spending on social programs and infrastructure in order to make American corporations more competitive on a global scale, along with banking deregulations and other changes that allowed corporations to move much of their manufacturing and low-level processes offshore, meant that in cities you had higher levels of unemployment and a shift towards service jobs that generally paid less than other jobs. Cities in the 1990s needed to gain revenue to make up that lost revenue from the federal government, which essentially put them into competition with one another. David Harvey calls this the entrepreneurial cities, the idea that cities across the United States that had once been sort of nodes in a Keynesian national economy were now competing against each other for both tax dollars from corporate headquarters, many of which had moved with white flight out to the suburbs, as well as those individuals themselves. So they wanted to cater to middle class and wealthy consumers, and they wanted to create environments that made corporations and the well-educated and well-heeled folks that worked at those corporations and shopped in high-end retail and bring those back into the city as a mechanism for raising revenues that had been lost to federal government. So part of that meant that making the city safe for middle and upper class consumers and residents meant removing those things that people found threatening or scary or undesirable about cities, which it concluded, I'm just going to leave it at poor people.
That's Tony Sparks. He's Associate Professor of Urban Studies and Planning at San Francisco State University. And we are talking about an article he contributed to the journal Social Justice about broken windows policing and the effects of that kind of policing approach on homeless people with mental illness, specifically in San Francisco. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Okay, let's talk about your focus in this piece, which is San Francisco, although I think one can learn a lot about issues of national homelessness and housing insecurity and poverty and policing from this piece. So you used surveys. You went through, among other things, surveys done by the Coalition on Homelessness San Francisco. What made you go to that particular data set, and what were you hoping to glean from it?
Well, when I first moved to San Francisco, I was looking to engage with some of the advocates and activists around homelessness in San Francisco, and I met with Paul Bolden from the Western Regional Advocacy Project, and we talked about different research things that we might do, and he said, you know what we really need to do is we need to talk about how policing of homelessness is feeding people with mental illness into jails. He said, we all know it's true, and we don't have the data to show it. So that stuck with me, and I tried, and I had a really hard time figuring out how I was going to approach that research. I didn't know exactly what the best way to go about it. I tried to get jail data, and that was partially successful. Some participant observation that was partially successful. And then just by happenstance, I met with a guy named Chris Herring, who was working with the Coalition on Homelessness, to put together this report on the effects of policing in San Francisco on houseless folks. And he was working with the coalition. He mentioned that one of the questions they asked was self-reported data on mental disabilities and physical disabilities. And so I said, can I look at the data? And the coalition was happy to have me look at it. And so that's where this came from.
And what did you find out about the proportion of homeless people in San Francisco who struggle with mental health issues? Is it a large proportion, a significant proportion?
It is an issue for many people. About 30-35% of people in San Francisco who don't have housing also struggle with a mental disability of some sort. Now, I want to clarify that a little bit, because I believe there's a stereotype that people think that mental illness and homelessness sort of go hand in hand. And while it is the case that having mental illness or other difficulties makes being houseless difficult, the rate of mental illness amongst the homelessness is not tremendously different than the rate of homelessness amongst everybody in the United States, which hovers in the mid 20% range. I'm not sure of the exact number. So yes, there are people on the street with a mental illness. There are people everywhere with mental illness. It's not a particularly strong factor in why people become or why people remain homeless. That really revolves around poverty. Now, that said, what the data show is that if you do have those sorts of difficulties, then you're much more likely to have interaction with the police. You're much more likely to have deleterious consequences from those interactions. Your life is just generally more difficult than if you did not have a mental difficulty or disability.
And is that because people with mental disabilities may display certain behaviors and kind of appear to people and to police officers in a way that make them more likely to be approached and handled?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it is widely believed that homelessness is something you can see, that it's some sort of visible signifier that you know, some sort of a scarlet H on your shirt. But not having housing doesn't change the way you present. Now, that being said, because broken windows policing is specifically about removing disorder, those that appear disorderly are far more likely to be the targets of that kind of policing.
So police, and we're going to talk about this in some detail, but police approach people perceived, they perceive as disorderly or disheveled, or people who are drawing complaints from other people who live in the area, work in the area, you know, complaints as being disorderly. Is there any part of the duty of the police to protect people who they don't think or who don't come off as being able to protect and care for themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a long history of the part of the role of police being to care for those who can't care for themselves. It's sort of encapsulated in a legal doctrine called parens patria, the idea that part of the role of police is to act as parent, as in parens, towards those who are incapable of meeting their needs or who can't care or who are a danger to themselves or others. So certainly if you look at the history of policing, there is a long history of police dealing with and interacting with people with various issues, mental health issues, physical disability issues. So that in itself is not new. And I wanted to draw attention to that in the article, that it's not that police are stepping out of their lane. It's more that they're hamstrung, that there's very little they can do in terms of caring for those who can't care for themselves. The resources aren't there, and the spaces just aren't there. So police are largely left with very little at their disposal other than just to move people along or arrest them.
And why is that? Like, can you talk about when the shift away from treatment and services and toward policing and incarceration of people, when that shift took place, and why there was a massive defunding of support and treatment and housing?
Sure. And I don't want to give the impression that policing was absolutely benevolent in the past. Of course, those ugly laws and vagrancy statutes that I referred to earlier have been used by the police for a long time. And it is also true that many people were moved into large institutions in the past, that probably wasn't the best solution to that problem. So I don't want to suggest that the past was somehow better, because it very much wasn't. But it is true that starting, and I believe the early 1960s, there was a move to shift from big mental institutions, you know, like the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest sort of institutions, towards community care and community treatment that was driven largely by changes in how we thought of the fields of psychology and how we thought about therapy, and also changes in pharmacology and how we treat mental health. But although we were very successful at closing down those big, dehumanizing, often really crappy institutions, we never made that transition. We never put a significant amount of effort into providing those community-based services. So what we ended up with was we went from a not good one-size-fits-all dehumanizing safety net to no safety net at all.
And I take it the cuts in funding and support that affected the nation and that characterized the nation was also the situation in San Francisco?
Absolutely. The shift away from large mental institutions was the result of federal legislation and was something that happened across the country. Although I should say it happened much more strongly in California for two reasons. One, California had a large investment in mental health institutions, but also the deinstitutionalization movement began with then Governor Reagan and really was spearheaded here in California and probably the most extreme example of both the deinstitutionalization and the failure of community care to take its place.
Tony Sparks joins us on Against the Grain. He's Associate Professor of Urban Studies and Planning at San Francisco State University. So in this atmosphere or context of a lack of services, of not enough psychiatric facility slots, of inadequate housing, of treatment options that are not sufficient to address what's really happening on the streets and in the shelters of San Francisco, you write that the tactics of banishment, citation, and arrest have become the primary and sometimes only tools available to officers who respond to complaints about people without housing and people with mental health issues. Let's talk about these in turn. What do you mean by banishment?
Well, I'm using banishment in a couple of different ways. One, I want to call attention to banishment's medieval origins in terms of when one is removed from one's physical location, one is also removed from the legal protections that make one a citizen or a properly cared for member of society. And two, it's also used by another scholar, Steve Herbert and Catherine Beckett, in their book Banished, which is about this sort of policing and homelessness in San Francisco. So I wanted to draw on both senses of that word of banishment, of both banished as a nod to my scholarly colleagues and as a nod to it not being just about physical movement, but also a removal of one's humanity and one's ability to be afforded the protections that citizens are generally afforded.
And banishment, in terms of the specific interaction between a police officer and a person, a homeless person, for example, is embodied in this article in the words move along. So how often is someone enjoined, is someone ordered by the police to move along? And what would that mean? Like, what impact would that have on the person?
So move alongs, and they're called various things by various departments and, you know, police cultures. But simply put, they're the most common tactic of broken windows policing. And they're sort of the lowest stakes, or at least perceived as the lowest stakes. You know, you're sitting there doing whatever and a cop comes by and says, you know, take it somewhere else. Get it out of here. In San Francisco, that sometimes reaches comical sort of proportions, you know. Yeah, go do that over there because that's a different precinct than mine. But what that sort of takes for granted is that the idea that people are just there and that the space has no meaning, that moving along to one place or another place, like place doesn't make a difference. And for the people in the Coe study and the people I've interacted with, over the years, that's not the case at all. The reason they're in the places that they are is because those places are where they have their social networks. It's where they go to access services. It's where they feel safe and where they feel comfortable and where they feel wanted. And when they are asked to move along, even for short periods of time, those relationships and those sort of mechanisms of stability get fractured a little bit at a time.
So you're saying that move along might sometimes or might often mean you have to relocate out of this particular neighborhood or community, and that community is important to you for certain reasons, many of which you've just described?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not a one-time thing. It's a constant and non-predictable process. So at any given time, sometimes multiple times during the day, you might ask to be moved, might ask to move. And sometimes they're asking you to move a little ways, and sometimes they're asking you to stay away for longer. It pushes people continually out of their comfort zones in non-predictable ways.
Tony Sparks, he is a San Francisco State University professor, and we're talking about an article he's written about broken windows policing and its impact on homeless people with mental illness. We'll take a short break and speak more with Tony. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Tony Sparks joins me. He is Associate Professor of Urban Studies and Planning at San Francisco State University. And he's researched broken windows policing and theory and the effect of policing approaches, the broken windows policing approaches on homeless people with mental illness, specifically in San Francisco. He's also a member of the Human Rights Work Group of the Coalition on Homelessness San Francisco. You also mentioned in this piece that there are certain neighborhoods in San Francisco which are more kind of service provision heavy, that have more resources to bring to bear to help people who need help with mental health issues or housing issues. And so that being relocated forcibly out of such neighborhoods could have quite an impact on a person's stability, a person's safety.
Yeah, absolutely. Before I go further on that, I just want to go back to when I was talking about neoliberalism, because when I talked about it impacting poor people, I want to emphasize that this was a deeply racialized process, and it wasn't just poor people or poor people. It was poor people and people of color, and poor people of color particularly. When we talk about urban disorder, in air quotes, that we're talking about a deeply racialized perception of urban space. And that actually plays into the issue of neighborhoods too. In the 1970s and 80s, and I'm not sure if I'm getting my timeline exactly right here. I'm a geographer, not a historian, so bear with me on the fuzzy timeline. But when there were movements to build services for poor people, people in need of mental health resources, housing resources, those, because of you know, the typical sort of NIMBYism, nobody wants any sort of service near them, and also the conservative need to make public services as cheap as possible, the few and far between services that do exist in most American cities were put in places that were politically disempowered and economically deprived in that time period. These were largely poor minority neighborhoods, you know, post-white flight in the 1970s and 1980s. And those areas became hubs of social services. Michael Dear and Jennifer Walsh have referred to these as service-dependent ghettos, where people who need services are concentrated in particular parts of town by virtue of that's the one place where they can access the things that they need. Now, what has happened in recent years, of course, is cities have gentrified. And as cities have gentrified, the first places to gentrify have been those neighborhoods. So now those places where services have historically been located are now the homes of fancy hipster businesses and, you know, incredibly expensive condos. And the combination of the presence of people lugging their belongings or perhaps displaying the outward symptoms of mental illness and wealthy white folks has led to an increasing amount of policing in those areas. So in the survey, what we found was where the police contact was most pronounced were in those neighborhoods where people need to be to access the small, tattered safety net that exists in San Francisco.
So we've talked about banishment. Citation is the next tactic. One of the tools, some of the only tools available to responding officers in San Francisco. And I understand actually that the issuing of quality of life ordinance violation, the citations for such violations, are less used by the San Francisco police these days than when you wrote the article because of at least one court decision. But maybe speaking more generally and more nationally, what point do you want to make about what happens when a person without housing who has mental health issues is issued a citation, which, you know, imposes a fine, and they can't afford to pay the fine? What kind of road or path that might lead a person, right, who feels not quite right, who has some mental illness, what kind of path it might lead that person down?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, in San Francisco, although the tactics have changed a little bit, they still issue these citations. And I believe, in general, the issuance of citations as a mechanism for controlling and punishing poorest residents is fairly common. And, you know, there's a certain irony to this, that a citation comes with a fine, and it also comes with a presumption of guilt. A citation as opposed to a misdemeanor means you don't have right to an attorney or a right to a trial. So you get this citation for sitting and lying or drinking in public or whatever. And that comes with a fine that ranges, you know, somewhere between $100 and $300. And then what typically happens is, of course, that fine doesn't get paid. And we found this in the data from the coalition study. People don't pay their fines either because they forget or they lose them or they just refuse or they don't have the money. And then once they don't pay them, then late fees are assessed. Sometimes collection fees are assessed in many cities. At some point in San Francisco, at the time I wrote this, it was $7,000. Once you'd run up $7,000, your citations resulted in a bench warrant for your arrest. So people are then brought in based on these bench warrants. And even if they're in jail for very short periods of time, which is usually the case on these low-level crimes, people who don't have money for bail are held until their case can be adjudicated. In San Francisco, that time tended to be short, about less than a week. But to put this in context, about 80% of those who are in San Francisco County Jail are not convicted of anything. They're awaiting some sort of adjudication. So, you know, even for the best of us, this disrupts our lives and make things more difficult. For those people that are both in precarious housing situations or houseless and dealing with mental illness, that means, you know, they may not have access to the appropriate meds. It may mean they lose benefits as a result of having been in jail. Depending on where they're staying, they may lose their residence and not be able to reaccess their residence. They may lose access to federal benefits, Social Security and VA. So what happens is simply as a result of having nowhere to exist other than public space, people end up being deprived of the very things that would stabilize them and help them to both to lead productive lives and to potentially, you know, get out of being homeless.
If incarceration, even for a short period of time, could result in the discontinuance of government health benefits like Medicaid or Social Security, couldn't those benefits easily be resumed after somebody leaves prison, leaves jail?
So, I mean, yes, benefits can be resumed, but that's sort of not a simple process. They have to reapply. They have to meet with a caseworker. They may have to meet with a medical professional. And it doesn't happen overnight. It can take weeks and sometimes months. And if you're without housing and struggling with mental health issues, just trying to get where to sleep, where to eat, where to pee is a daily challenge. Going through all of these hurdles as well, just to get back to the place that you were prior to being incarcerated, can seem and sometimes even be insurmountable.
San Francisco County has a jail psychiatric services department that you write is fairly well funded, or at least it was when you wrote this article. How helpful is that for people in jail for, well, either significant periods of time or perhaps who are doing only short stints in jail?
Well, San Francisco's jail psych services, and you know, to be fair, I'm a geographer, I'm not a mental health person, is amazing. The people who work there are engaged. It's deeply ingrained within the culture there. It's well-respected, and it works, you know, well for what it does. Now, granted, jails should not be mental health facilities, but to the extent that they are, I think San Francisco is doing an excellent job. Now, one of the problems, though, is that because of the growth in the incarceration of people with mental illness over the past 20 years, that means there are very large backlogs. It takes weeks, sometimes months, to be able to see somebody. There are specific programs, wraparound programs for people with mental health issues exiting the justice system, but the wait to get into those programs is months long. So San Francisco has something called the Behavioral Health Court that people for whom their mental health status was a major factor in their being incarceration can get into a collaborative court system that helps them navigate post-incarceration and move them into a more stable situation. But the wait for that is many months long. And so people who the sort of small offenders that I'm talking about in this article would often never encounter jail psych services or meet with a medical professional of any kind. And even if they do, oftentimes they don't come in with their medical histories. So they may meet with a doctor once, but that doctor has very little to go on other than how that person is presenting at the time. And even then, the person is generally released a week or 2 weeks later. And in those cases, there's no follow-up or wraparound treatment at all. So people are sort of brought in, systematically discombobulated, and then released back out on the street with no help at all.
Well, it's a powerful irony here, isn't it, that you would have to stay in jail longer in order to qualify for these services. And so, in a sense, the brevity of one's stay for some of these low-level warrant offenses works against you. Now, obviously, you know, there are severe consequences, as you said, to even a short stint in jail, but this prevents people, it sounds like, from accessing the very services that would help them.
Absolutely. It not only prevents people from accessing the services that would help them, but, you know, for most people, this isn't a one-time occurrence, that this is something that is ongoing, the cycle of being moved along, of being cited, of being arrested. And each time somebody goes through that cycle, they fall a little bit further down the ladder. They're less able to access the services. They may be less able to access their informal networks. The less able to access services and informal networks that exist, the more potential for an increase in symptoms or decompensation and a decrease in the ability to meet one's daily needs.
Tony Sparks is his name, Associate Professor of Urban Studies and Planning at San Francisco State University. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. He again contributed an article called Reproducing Disorder, The Effects of Broken Windows Policing on Homeless People with Mental Illness in San Francisco, to the journal Social Justice. You know, and this language, reproducing disorder, I want to get to that now because this has to do, I think, with the way in which people or the state in which people are when they leave jail. So, you know, maybe they've been cited. They've definitely been taken into custody. They're in this place, in this jail. It's disorienting. And as you said, in the meantime, maybe they've, you know, lost whatever job they had on the outside. Maybe they lost their place in the SRO or the shelter. Maybe they've lost maybe government health benefits. So what is it about the way they come out of jail and the whole reason, I guess, to put them into jail? I mean, this is part of a whole system of trying to deal with people who are perceived to be disordered and disheveled and kind of unfit to be in public spaces. What does this do to the appearance and the behavior of people coming out, and how might that affect their interactions with police after they get out?
Well, this is one of, I think, the biggest ironies of the whole study. And let me back up a little bit, because we've been throwing around this term disorder, I feel like, a little carelessly. And I do want to emphasize that disorder is not something that exists out there on its own as sort of a fully fledged out concept, right? Disorder is a relational concept. What is considered disorderly is that which appears out of place or dangerous or discomforting to a, in the United States, a white middle class heterosexual norm. So I just want to put that out there, that we're not talking about disorder as if it's something that really exists, but disorder as something very specifically not sort of white and wealthy. But in terms of the reproducing of disorder, this is really what I found to be the irony of the whole study. And this was what drove me to write it, because I saw this on the street, was that the upshot of these policing tactics, you're not just incarceration, which is of course the most extreme, but even move-alongs and the separation of people from their informal networks meant that people were less able to remain stable. So, you know, somebody would be released from jail, for instance, and they would have been there for 5 or 6 days. They wouldn't have access to, they may have lost access to their things, you know, if those things were left on the street or left in an SRO. They may not have had access to their meds. Their meds may have been confiscated or lost. So people come out of each of these situations looking more and more disordered than they did coming in. And I mean that in particular in relation to our stereotype of the homeless folk who are, you know, talking to themselves on the street and maybe smell a little bad and look a little disheveled and are dragging their few belongings with us. What I really found here was that many times that visible signifier of homelessness wasn't something, or was something that was produced by the tactics of policing that we use to manage that population. Their disheveled appearance was a result of the deprivation of these spaces and services. Their lack of meds and their talking to themselves were a deprivation of being able to access meds and services. And so, you know, there's this great irony of the whole point of broken windows policing is to maintain order and reduce the level of bodies that make that middle class norm uncomfortable. And the upshot is those very tactics are creating that very situation and person.
And it makes it impossible, it sounds like, for the person without housing, the person with mental health issues, mental disabilities, mental illness, it makes it impossible for them to gain the stability they need in order to do what maybe the police or the middle class folks want, which is to act in a different way, to appear in a different way.
Absolutely. There's an interview, it didn't make it in the article, but an interaction I had with a guy who described this situation as, you know, when he lost his home, he felt like he had been knocked on his back and got the wind knocked out of him. And his interactions since then had been that what he called the system was continually just knocking his feet out from under him over and over and over again. Every time he tried to crawl up to his knees, somebody would knock him down again and he would start all over. And I think that analogy really described what the experience on the street for many of those folks.
Yeah, and I want to follow up on what you said, because in my question, I focused on people coming out of jail, but what you were saying briefly was that this could happen, this sense of increasing disorientation could happen simply from, and it's not a simple matter, but simply from being told to move along, being forced to go to an area where they don't feel safe or secure or have access to the same level of services.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Each of these stages that I described in here, the banishment, citation, and incarceration, are really increasing levels of intensification of the same set of processes and consequences. And any one of these alone or taken together when occurring on a continuing and ongoing and unpredictable basis is in itself productive of disorder and disorderly bodies.
So what are you hoping people will take away from this article in the journal Social Justice in terms of how they perceive people who they see who are apparently homeless, apparently disorderly on the streets, and what kind of policy might be affected that might be more effective than broken windows policing?
Okay, let me break this down into three bits. In terms of effective policies, I will take them in reverse. In terms of effective policies, San Francisco already has some policies that are really on the forefront of national trends in dealing with people with mental challenges and illnesses. One is the Behavioral Health Court, which is a collaborative court that works where the public defender and the prosecutor and the judge all work together to create a system of stability and treatment to move people into stable housing. And there have been efforts afoot to expand that model. You know, it hasn't been around that long, but it has been highly successful. There's been a few studies done that behavioral health courts reduce recidivism. They stabilize their clients. The other thing that San Francisco has been doing for quite some time now is CIT, or crisis intervention training for the police, which trains officers to be frontline responders, to recognize the symptoms of mental illness, to work to de-escalate potentially dangerous situations. This too has shown to be fairly successful. Now, both of these have their drawbacks. Both of these are underfunded. Both of these lack availability in terms of CIT training. It's not mandatory. It's voluntary. And at the end of the day, despite how effective these might be, these are without the sort of services available for people with mental illness, then these things are sort of pointless. If the police continue to have no place other than confinement in a mental hospital or what we call in California a 5150 hold, if that's the only thing available to a policeman, and even that system is wildly overloaded, then no amount of training is going to help. And I feel it's the same with the behavioral health court. One of the biggest drawbacks is that without access to the services that the behavioral health court needs to be successful, beds for people to stay in, available caseworkers and counselors, drop-in shelters and outpatient clinics, and even inpatient facilities. Without these things, then these approaches are simply Band-Aids on a much bigger problem. To back up from that a little bit more, one of the things that my own takeaways from this article in working with people on the street and coming out of the courts and with the coalition is that we tend to think of folks who are homeless or have mental health issues or have substance abuse issues in terms of their diagnoses, that we say, yeah, this person is a human, but, and, you know, that little preposition has the effect of removing one's humanity in really important ways. And I think what often gets lost, even to those people who are doing their best to improve a crappy situation, is that people on the streets are bright, resourceful, organized, driven folks, that they are creating networks and they're meeting their own needs and they're finding the services and they're sharing the resources. And, you know, I think to think of them as simply consumers of resources that are being provided by the state or providing by nonprofits is really in many times to do some harm without taking into account the ways in which people are finding ways to manage in their own lives and really building on those assets.
Tony Sparks. He teaches urban studies and planning at San Francisco State University. He's a member of the Human Rights Workgroup of the Coalition on Homelessness San Francisco. And you can check out his article about the effects of broken windows policing on homeless people with mental illness in San Francisco in the journal Social Justice. Tony, thanks very much for your work and thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.